Good afternoon. My name is Preet Bharara, and I'm the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Today, we unseal charges against 9 men for wide-ranging crimes of corruption in New York. The allegations include bribery, bid rigging, extortion, fraud, and false statements. The defendants include not just government insiders, but also corporate executives who made the criminal decision to pay bribes to help their companies. One of the 9 men is Todd Howe, a powerful and connected lobbyist with close ties to the governor's office. As to Howe, the charges have already been proven. Yesterday, he pled guilty to an 8-count information and is cooperating with the government. As to the other 8 men, the charges at this stage are still merely allegations, but we intend to prove every single one of them at a fair trial in federal court. The charges against these 8 men are laid out in a detailed complaint that runs to about 80 single-spaced pages. I commend it to your attention, the actual document, because I have time to give only a brief summary this afternoon. In essence, today's complaint shines a light on yet another sordid side of the show-me-the-money culture that has so plagued government in Albany. It turns out that the state legislature does not have any kind of monopoly on crass corruption in New York. The complaint describes 2 overlapping criminal schemes. In the first, we allege that Joseph Prococo, the former executive deputy secretary to the governor, and therefore one of the most powerful people in all of New York, was on the take. Specifically, we allege that over time, he solicited over $320,000 in bribes from 2 different companies with business before the state in exchange for official actions in their favor. In the second scheme, we allege pervasive corruption and fraud in the Buffalo Billion Initiative and similar programs. Specifically, we intend to prove that real estate developers in Buffalo and Syracuse paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to Todd Howe while they knew Todd Howe was also working for the state, supposedly to run a fair bidding process for state contracts. They made these payments, we allege, to be guaranteed to win those contracts. In other words, hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes for hundreds of millions of dollars in state contracts. In each case, the bids were rigged and the results were preordained. Companies got rich and the public got bamboozled. So let me spend just a couple of minutes on each of the schemes described in the complaint. So as I said, first, we allege a scheme in which Joseph Prococo abused his enormous power and influence as one of the governor's closest aides to obtain bribes from 2 companies, one described in the complaint as the energy company and the other as the Syracuse developer. Alleged bribes paid by the energy company were arranged by another defendant, Peter Galbraith Kelly, who was working on behalf of that company to win state approvals for a $900 million power plant in upstate New York. We allege a classic quid pro quo. Here was the alleged quid. Kelly, we say, concocted a $90,000 a year low-show job for Joe Prococo's wife. While getting paid $90,000 a year, Prococo's wife, we say, never did more than 25 hours of work in a month, sometimes working as little as 2 or 3 hours in an entire month. And the alleged quo, we say that Prococo was essentially on call for the energy company, repeatedly called upon to exert official pressure on multiple state officials to find ways to help the energy company. There's a lot of detail there, and that's laid out in the complaint at pages 33 to 38. The complaint also alleges that Prococo was persistent in demanding bribe money and shows that official actions taken were done for that money. As the complaint describes, Prococo and Howe used a colorful coded term for that bribery money, ziti, which they apparently lifted from an episode of The Sopranos, as in, and this is described in the complaint, quote, keep the ziti flowing, close quote, and, quote, don't tip over the ziti wagon, close quote. The second company that allegedly bribed Prococo was a Syracuse real estate development firm run by defendants Stephen Aiello and Joseph Girardi. In return for at least $35,000 in bribe payments, Prococo allegedly helped the company in its dealings with the Empire State Development Corporation, helped free up millions of dollars in state funds to be paid to the company, and even got Aiello's son, who worked in the governor's office, a raise. In all, we allege that Prococo and his wife pocketed some $322,000 over the course of about 4 years. Now to the second scheme. The second scheme, we allege, involves corruption and bid rigging at the heart of massive state development projects, including the so-called Buffalo Billion program. As alleged, through rigged bids, state contracts worth nearly $1 billion for public development projects meant to revitalize and renew upstate New York were instead just another way to corruptly reward cronies willing to pay to play. Elaine Calieros, the president of SUNY Polytechnic, and Todd Howe publicly made it appear as if these contracts were being awarded through a fair and open bidding process. But behind the scenes, they were cynically rigging the whole process so that the contracts would go to hand-picked friends of the administration, friends being a euphemism for large donors. Howe made money on both sides. He served both as a paid consultant of the nonprofit running the bidding process and also as a paid consultant to the developers seeking the contracts. This was, of course, an inherently corrupt arrangement. With the heavy hand of Calieros and Howe, bid proposals were secretly tailored to favor either the Syracuse developer or the Buffalo developer, respectively. Rather than run a real bid, as was required by law and expected by the public, Calieros and Howe, we allege, ran a rigged process. There are a lot of examples in the complaint. I'll give you a couple. One, the companies basically got to write the RFPs, the request for proposal, themselves, often dictating the specific qualifications so they themselves would best qualify. For example, when the Syracuse developer saw that an RFP for the contract it wanted required audited financials, which is an understandable requirement, you would think, Aiello and Girardi got Calieros to change it because a similar requirement for audited financials had previously disqualified the company from another contract. The rigging of the bids became so blatant that at one point the Syracuse developer expressed concern in the margins of a draft RFP that was secretly shared with him, wondering, was that too telegraphed? Meaning, maybe they were being even themselves too obvious and needed to be more subtle. Similarly, with the Buffalo RFP, Calieros included a requirement, which has been reported in the press, that the winning bid had to go to a local developer with over 50 years of experience, which would only qualify to one developer, conveniently a qualification held by Louis Simonelli's company. Calieros later claimed, when there was some outcry publicly, that it was a typo, claiming that the RFP was supposed to say 15 years, not 50. Even an executive with the Buffalo developer admitted in an email to Simonelli that, quote, 50 was a bit obnoxious. We allege it was more than obnoxious, that it was criminal. What I've described for you are depicted in these two charts. First, I talked about the alleged Prococo bribery scheme, Scheme 1, set forth in the complaint. As you see, we allege that Joseph Prococo solicited bribes and payments from two entities, the energy company, Syracuse developer, one to the tune of $287,000, the other to the tune of $35,000, and took various official actions, including trying to get them an energy purchase agreement and an energy credit deal. That's for the energy company. And on the other side, for the Syracuse developer, various things, including reversing a pro-union decision. And that, we allege, is the quid pro quo that we say is classic in nature. With respect to the bid rigging scheme, similarly, you see the reappearance, allegedly, of the Syracuse developer. Here we have Todd Howe is working on both sides, both along with Elaine Calieros, to put together the development programs and go over the bidding process, but at the same time was making an extraordinary amount of money, $100,000 a year from the Buffalo developer, $168,000 a year, plus a huge bonus from the Syracuse developer, in order to make sure that they got the contracts that they wanted, while also being in control of the bidding process in the first place. And you see that in the end, the rigged state contract process that we allege brought the Buffalo developer something like $750 million in projects and the Syracuse developer $105 million in projects. We wouldn't be here without the extraordinary work of a lot of folks, and I want to thank them. I want to thank the FBI, represented here today by Adam Cohen, special agent in charge of the Buffalo Field Office, for their tremendous work in this investigation. In particular, I want to thank Supervisory Special Agent Robert Gross and Special Agents Gary Jensen, Ben Farnsworth, and Kathleen Garber for their really exemplary work on this investigation. I also want to thank the IRS, with whom we work closely on this case, represented here by Special Agent in Charge Chantel Kitchen. And in particular, I want to thank one of her folks, Special Agent Karen Flanagan. I want to recognize the New York State Attorney General's Office, who has their own separate investigation into related conduct. We appreciate their cooperation and coordination with our office. And last but never least, I want to thank the folks in my own office, the career prosecutors and investigators who have killed themselves to make this very complicated case and sweeping case in just about a year. They have been relentless, thorough, and thoughtful, as they always are, and I thank them for it. In particular, I want to thank Assistant U.S. Attorneys Janice Eckenberg, Robert Boone, David Zhao, Matthew Podolsky, led by the Chief of our Public Corruption Unit, Andrew Goldstein. I also want to thank our incredible investigators who worked around the clock as well, Eric Blackman and Delissa Penland. As I said at the beginning, these charges are just allegations, and eight of the defendants are right now presumed innocent. Guilt to be determined or not at trial. And I will tell you, I really do hope that there's a trial in this case so that all New Yorkers can see in gory detail what their state government has been up to. Now let me bring to the podium Special Agent in Charge of the FBI's Buffalo Field Office, Adam Cohen.
Thank you, U.S. Attorney Barrera. Good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As the U.S. Attorney said, my name is Adam Cohen. I'm the special agent in charge of the FBI office in Buffalo. Just as important as that, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born in Brooklyn and raised on Long Island. After heading off to Boston for college, I returned to New York to work for local government in the town of Islip. And while that was not an elected position, I very, very much liked the idea of serving the public. In 1997, I joined the FBI, and ironically, my FBI career quickly brought me back to New York City, where I worked terrorism investigations. After a stint in Washington, D.C., it came time for me to apply for agent-in-charge positions, and I chose the Buffalo office. And once again, I found myself happy to be back in New York State. So you may notice a pattern here. New Yorkers have a way of finding our way back home. So while I work for an agency that covers the globe, it's apparent that I focused much of my life and my career here in New York State. Native New Yorkers and transplants to the state understand that's a very special place to call home, and we're very protective of New York. That's why this case, which entails aspects of public corruption in all of our most recognizable cities throughout the state, is not only professionally problematic for the FBI, but it's also personally upsetting, not only to me, but to the agents, the investigators, and the prosecutors whose dedicated efforts led to the arrests that you've just heard about. While I am relatively new to Western New York State, in the last year, I've come to learn much about the region, its rich history, and its early 20th century prosperity. With the Erie Canal, with Lake Erie, it was known far and wide. Back then, Buffalo was a true economic hub, valued for its ample fresh water and convenient trade routes. The grain, steel, and auto industries all flourished. Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture and Frederick Law Olmsted's parks and parkways further enhance the region's draw and beauty. It was a rich and a vibrant city, and it was loved by all of those who called it home. But by mid-century, there was an economic downturn in the region. For decades, it lost the things that gave it its value, its jobs, and its people. The population dropped as the area struggled economically. But if you fast forward to 2012, that's when things were added to Buffalo's rich history, and it became a new history. With an influx of government money and subsidies and lots of hardworking people, there are now places like the Canal Side District, the Harbor Center, the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, and Riverbend. With the help of New York State, the city of Buffalo started making headway in its vision to emerge successful and prosperous once again, to now become developed and modernized through new success and growth, beckoning the still familiar memories of a century ago. Today, there's an excitement about the future of Western New York, something very new, but something long hoped for. We often hear people use words loosely, such as rebirth or revitalization, when they talk about development. But those words, those things, are actually happening in Buffalo today. And the Buffalo Billion should have helped to regrow Buffalo. By supplementing the existing hopes of the hardworking people and the businesses that chose to stay and build the region, but the new construction and its promises of increased economic development and jobs have now been tainted by the acts of people who held positions of power. People who abused the programs that were put in place to not only better the region, but to also better the lives of New Yorkers who love to live and work in the state. The arrests announced today by U.S. Attorney Barrera speak volumes to those who arrogantly take what is not theirs, who act without morals and ignore ethics, those who willingly break the law because they choose greed. The people arrested today personally tarnished an historic opportunity that they had no right to tamper with. They compromised the integrity of government and impeded the promise of liberty. And they did it in New York State, and they did it throughout New York State. New Yorkers should not and will not stand for it. We cannot say it often enough. It's the expectation of the public that government officials are not in their positions to self-deal or to serve their personal interests. Thank you. And with that, I'll turn it back to the U.S. Attorney.
Thank you. Now we'll hear from the head of the IRS here in New York, Chantel Kitchen.
Good afternoon. My name is Chantel Kitchen, and I'm a special agent in charge of the New York Field Office of IRS Criminal Investigation. I would like to thank the U.S. Attorney for this opportunity to make some brief comments before you today. As the law enforcement arm of the Internal Revenue Service, IRS Criminal Investigation is responsible for investigating criminal tax fraud and related financial crimes. Our expertise as financial investigators take us, IRS criminal investigation special agents, into investigations involving all kinds of willfully unreported sources of taxable income, both legal and illegal. Like our partners in the United States Attorney's Office and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, we take allegations of public corruption by public officials and public employees very seriously. And we are always ready to contribute to an investigation when the allegation of corruption involves a financial component. I emphasize that illegal source income, including bribes, is in fact taxable and must be reported. Voluntary compliance is the... Who has to file a United States tax return does so timely, accurately, and honestly. The honest taxpayer's confidence in the tax system depends on everyone paying their fair share. regardless of their occupation, wealth, or prominence, or their public office or position. Finally, this investigation is another example of the successful partnership between the prosecutors, investigators of this United States Attorney's Office, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and IRS criminal investigation. I look forward to having more to say at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you, Chantel. Happy to take some questions.
A few months ago, you issued a statement regarding matters you had investigated on the Moreland Commission, giving Governor Cuomo essentially a clean bill of health. Can you make the same statement and give Governor Cuomo a clean bill of health on matters related to the charges that you've investigated and the charges today? Yeah.
What I can say at this moment is that there are no allegations of any wrongdoing or misconduct by the governor anywhere in this complaint. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah.
Is there anything in particular about the Buffalo Billing contracting process that you think allowed it to be exploited in this way?
Was there anything wrong in the Buffalo Billing contract? Yeah, well, I think if you read the complaint, you see, I'm not going to prescribe particular ways in which the oversight should have been better and whether or not there were more questions that should have been asked. And obviously, when people are engaged in fraud and are not revealing things, we see this time and time again in lots of cases that we bring, it's not always possible to know that the fraud is taking place. So, for example, I think we lay out in the complaint that the Fort Schuyler Board, which was established to basically oversee some of this contracting, did not know that Todd Howe was being paid also by the companies as a consultant, so that he was on both ends of the process. I leave it to others to figure out what could be better about the bidding process, but one of the reasons we bring these cases is not only to hold the particular individuals accountable, but to provide details for the public to understand what bad conduct took place, and for people who are in a position to make sure it doesn't happen again, to adopt those reforms. So it may be the case that there should be some. Yeah.
In the complaint, you refer explicitly to Rococo as the governor's right-hand man. You make it very clear also that Lane Gongaros, who was the head of the Student Bob Technic, another organization, effectively under the executive branch and the governor's direction in one of his signature plans, was helping to rig bids in favor of donors to the governor's campaign. Is it, in your view, realistic to believe the governor was completely oblivious to all of this going on in his branch of government?
Yeah, it's not my job to comment on what is realistic or not realistic. We bring particular charges against particular people, and I said before, and I'll say again, there's no allegation of wrongdoing on the part of the governor in this complaint. Yeah.
Was the governor interviewed as part of this investigation? If so, what arrangements were made?
What arrangements were made? Like refreshments?
Yes.
I don't comment on who we interviewed and who we didn't, unless it's something that is revealed specifically in the complaint. Yeah.
You've said repeatedly now that there's no allegations of wrongdoing involving the governor in this complaint. Is the investigation ongoing, and do you anticipate that there could be further charges considered involving anybody else in state government, including the governor?
Yeah. Anytime we bring a case like this where there are a lot of allegations and a lot of defendants, we bring it at the time we think makes sense to bring it, when we brought to closure a certain part of the investigation. This investigation, as a general matter, remains open, like many other investigations, as a general matter, remain open. Yeah.
If you were making donations to Governor Cuomo for the election campaign, does that implicate him, and are those donations contingent to the firm, for example?
The recitation of donations made in the complaint are part of the background context of the relationship between various defendants that we charge today. In other words, relations between people who are soliciting what we characterize as bribe payments, and people who are willing to pay them or were extorted into paying them. So it provides some background on the motivations on the part of the folks who were paying bribes, showing that they wanted to curry favor in a particular way. The crux of the criminal complaint, though, is what I've described and what's depicted on these charts, and that is the illicit payments, most of which were not disclosed, in the Prococo circumstance as depicted on this chart, and in the bid rigging scheme as depicted on that chart. Yeah.
Since you've been working on all these different cases involving all different figures from all of them, have you noticed that it has changed, gotten better, or is it just as bad as often?
Has the situation in Albany gotten better
since you started working on all these cases?
I presume some people have gotten the message and abstained from engaging in criminal activity, but we're as busy as we ever were, maybe busier. So to the extent that's a proxy for whether or not things have gotten better, I don't know. But the evidence The only metrics I have are how many cases and investigations and people we're charging with respect to how government operates in the state. And if that's the metric you use, then the assessment is not a positive one. And by the way, I want to make clear that when I say Albany, I'm talking about government in Albany. And Albany is a wonderful town, as the mayor has told me multiple times, and which I know to be true. Yeah.
You mentioned that the state legislature doesn't have a monopoly on all of this, just to follow up on this question. Now that you've found this kind of corruption in the executive branch, what does it say to you about the state of New York State government currently? And can we trust it?
I think the cases have been speaking. I speak from time to time about the state of affairs. The cases speak much, much more loudly than any small snippet of rhetoric that I would provide. And when you have an 80-page complaint here, and we'll wait to prove those charges in court, and we expect and hope that we will, but you have long complaints and indictments with respect to many, many officials going back a number of years now, and when you see people engaging in misconduct year after year after year, and not a tiny percent, not everyone, there are a lot of great, honorable public servants in the executive branch, in the legislative branch, and that's true everywhere. But it is a bit disheartening, as I think the cases make plain, when you see not just particular individuals engaging in misconduct, but again, if we prove the allegations in this case, it's not just about particular transgressions on the part of particular people, but a systemic problem. So you have you're not just one person doing something wrong, we allege, but a whole system and network of folks, insiders and also corporate executives, with respect to huge infrastructure projects and development projects in the state. So it's not small stuff, like some kinds of public corruption cases that you see. This is big time stuff, and it goes to the core of how I think state government operates, and it's distressing and disconcerting.
Yeah.
Yeah, with respect to Rahami, I'm not in a position to give you a medical update. I don't know what's public and what's known, but I can't do that. With respect to whether or not a particular retained defense lawyer said on behalf of a particular charged defendant today that he may or may not make an argument in court, either pretrial or at trial, that a certain Supreme Court decision precludes our charging, we can decide that in court. But obviously, we're in the habit of reading Supreme Court precedent that affects the basis for our making cases, and we believe that we're well within what is allowed in terms of charging. Yeah.
Last question. What impact has the government done with KCAT on bringing these types of cases? Why do you think these charges can overcome whatever regulations
I don't want to give a lecture on Supreme Court jurisprudence at the moment, but McDonnell essentially said that there are certain kinds of action that the court would not find to be official action, such as merely arranging meetings or engaging in certain kinds of constituent service. We allege very specifically, and that's why I pointed to the 6 pages of the complaint with respect to the first scheme, that time and time again, Joe Prococo, for example, engaged in specific official conduct by putting the arm on other officials who were in government to get them to engage in favorable action, concrete favorable action, for the people who were paying him in an undisclosed way. So that'll be argued about in court, but you can imagine that the folks in our office and the agents with whom we work were very careful and thorough in bringing allegations that we think are outside of the scope of what the McDonnell case narrowed. Thanks, everyone.